Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Don't Take It Personally, Personalness and Impersonality in Social Life by Evyatar Zerubbabel. Narrated by Stephen R. Thorne. Preface. This book was conceived on the morning of November 5th, 2020. As I was preparing to teach a classical sociological theory class that was to feature a major sociological phenomenon that had fascinated me for more than four decades, namely, the inherent tension between our personal and impersonal visions of personhood. But it was the extra academic, ultimately political nature of that particular moment that led me to decide to write this book. Only two nights earlier, I had watched the returns of a historic U.S. presidential election featuring two diametrically contrasting fundamental visions of political authority. On one side was the sitting president, Donald Trump, whose entire re-election campaign revolved around himself personally, while on the other was Joe Biden, who focused instead on the institution of the presidency. Whereas Trump emphasized his singularity, Biden presented himself as a prospective heir to a 45-person figurative line of occupants of that position, thereby highlighting the latter's pronouncedly impersonal character. Having just published a couple of weeks earlier a book about the fundamental theoretico-methodological tension between studying the specific and the generic, I was particularly sensitized to the somewhat parallel tension between our personal and impersonal visions of personhood. That tension further deepened during the following 2 months, as Trump refused to concede his defeat, leading to his historically unprecedented violent attempt to decertify the official election results. Then on January 23, 2021, 3 days after Biden's inauguration, I began writing this book. Yet, while cheering the triumph of impersonal law over personal charisma, I have also been long aware of impersonality's equally obvious discontents, so perfectly captured by my almost visceral response to the often patronizing common expressions, "It's nothing personal," and "Don't take it personally." I also feel deeply annoyed at receiving telemarketing robocalls or trying to reason with an automated customer representative. East Brunswick, New Jersey, March 2023. Chapter 1. Who versus what? The sociologist is concerned with King John, not with King John. Lewis A. Kozer, Masters of Sociological Thought, 180. In her perfectly titled romantic drama, Sir, filmmaker Rowena Guerra sensitively recounts the subtly evolving relationship between wealthy Mumbai architect Ashwin and his live-in maid, Ratna. The two become increasingly closer, even exchanging personal gifts, yet Ratna nevertheless insists on calling Ashwin Sir, despite his repeated protests. "How long are you going to call me Sir? Please don't call me that." Their growing mutual affection notwithstanding, India's extremely rigid class distinctions effectively prevent Ratna from venturing to cross the strict traditional social barrier separating them from each other, and she ultimately quits her job and moves out of Ashwin's apartment. The film ends, however, with her hesitantly picking up her ringing cell phone, hearing Ashwin's voice, and after a long, resounding silence, finally uttering his name. The subtle, yet unmistakably fundamental socio-semiotic contrast between using someone's title and his or her proper name is likewise highlighted by the following exchange between President Andrew Shepherd and his chief of staff, as well as old buddy A.J. McInerney, in Rob Reiner and Aaron Sorkin's The American President. AJM. Good night, Mr. President. AS. AJ. AJM. Yes, sir. AS. When we are out of the office and alone, you can call me Andy. AJM. I beg your pardon. AS. You were the best man in my wedding, for crying out loud. Call me Andy. AJM. Whatever you say, Mr. President. Imagine also in this regard the following hypothetical situation, ponders law professor Rosanna Summers, in which Frank and Ellen meet at a night course and end up getting drinks together after class several times. The drinks start to feel like dates, so Ellen asks Frank if he is married, making it clear that adultery would be a deal-breaker for her. Frank is married, yet lies, and says he is single. The two go to bed. Is Frank guilty of rape? After all, she explains, Ellen did not consent to have sex with a married man, so the sex she had with Frank was not consensual. Indeed, consider the somewhat similar case of Sabar Kashour, a Palestinian from East Jerusalem, who was sentenced by an Israeli court to 18 months in jail for having committed so-called rape by deception. 2 years ago, Kashour met a Jewish woman on the street in Jerusalem. He worked as a messenger for an Israeli law firm, and, like some other Palestinians looking to integrate more effectively into Israeli society, had assumed the identity of a Jew. He called himself Dudu, a common Israeli name. On the same day, the two had a consensual sexual encounter in a nearby office building. The woman did not know Kashour was an Arab. When she found out, she filed a complaint with police. Kashour spent 2 years under house arrest facing a charge of rape and sexual assault. It was later dropped into one of rape by deception in a plea bargain. In his verdict, Judge Zvi Siegel wrote, "If she hadn't thought the accused was a Jewish bachelor, she would not have cooperated." The profound socio-semiotic contrast between the personal and social identities respectively attached to the designations Ashwin and Sir, Andy and Mr. President, Frank and a married man, and Dudu and a Jewish bachelor underscores a fundamental distinction between two contrasting visions of personhood: personalness and impersonality. And when Ratna finally utters Ashwin's name, it basically marks the symbolic transformation of an essentially impersonal relationship between two unspecified and thereby generic individuals, an employer and an employee, into an effectively personal relationship between two specific ones, Ashwin and Ratna. The tremendous tension between the mental acts of envisioning, and thereby relating to people personally and impersonally, is indeed the main theme of Cy Crane and Herbert Wiener's aptly titled Platter's song, "I'm Just a Dancing Partner," which opens with the following set of identity-probing questions. Am I just another dancing partner? Do you smile at every boy this way? Do you hold them all until they're breathless? Do you always find nice things to say? When this dance is over, will you dance with me once more? The fundamental contrast between the designations me and just another dancing partner, as well as every boy, or for that matter, all, of course, is essentially one between personalness and impersonality. And whereas the former effectively relates to specific individuals, Ashwin, Andy, Frank, Dudu, me, distinctly characterized by their singularity, the latter views them as members of certain generic categories: an employer, a president, a married man, a Jewish bachelor, just another dancing partner. Rather than focusing on their specificity in an effort to capture who they are, Romeo, Juliet, It thus foregrounds their genericity, effectively featuring what they are. A Montague, a Capulet. Specific who personhood. In marked contrast to impersonality, personalness features particular individuals, effectively characterized by their distinctiveness and therefore idiosyncrasies. In other words, it involves an essentially personocentric vision of people, and as evidenced by the considerable semiotic contrast between the designations a dog and rover, as well as of our pets, that highlights their singularity as unique individuals, as officially emblematized by their pronouncedly distinctive personal signature, social security number, account user ID and password, and fingerprints. Such vision of personhood also underlies the notion of individuals' distinctive personal style, as evidenced, for example, in art. Frédéric Chopin, Jackson Pollock, Ingmar Bergman, haute cuisine, sport, Muhammad Ali, Nadia Comaneci, Lionel Messi, as well as humor, Woody Allen, Bill Maher, Stephen Colbert, or, for that matter, sound, Billie Holiday, Paul Desmond, Edith Piaf. Essentially envisioning the individual as effectively detachable from any social group or community of which he or she is a member, personalness has also given rise to ultimately person-centric literary genres such as the diary, the memoir, the biography, and the novel, which basically feature specific individuals. In stark contrast to epic poems and allegorical tales, for example, the novel, argues Ian Watt, is distinctly characterized by its pronounced effort to singularize its characters as completely individualized entities, instead of as unspecified human types. Consider, for instance, in this regard, the way Emma describes her husband Charles in Gustave Flaubert's Madame Bovary. As he grew older, his manner grew heavier. After eating, he cleaned his teeth with his tongue. In taking soup, he made a gurgling noise with every spoonful. Such ultimately idiosyncratic details are highly particularized, and as such, distinctly characteristic of the novel as an artistic genre. Can one even imagine using such details in characterizing effectively archetypal and thereby unmistakably impersonalized mythical figures such as Shiva, Elijah, Prometheus, or Quetzalcoatl? As exemplified, for instance, by Stefan Zweig's novella Letter from an Unknown Woman, as well as Paul McCartney's song Michelle, personalness also underlies our romantic notion of love. Like Ashwin and Ratna's cross-class romance, Edward VIII's willingness to abdicate the British throne in order to be able to marry two-time divorcee Wallis Simpson, the woman I love, perfectly emblematizes lovers' defiance of effectively impersonal interpersonal barriers. William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet and Gary Marshall and J.F. Lawton's Pretty Woman are some classic manifestations of such pronouncedly person-centric sentiment. By the same token, in essentially foregrounding friends' distinctiveness, as when choosing with whom to share one's intimate personal information, or trying to anticipate on whose help one can count in moments of need, friendship perfectly exemplifies such vision of personhood. Friends, after all, are distinctly characterized by their singularity as special, and as such, ultimately specific individuals. Personalness, of course, also underlies our effectively singularized notions of both celebrity and charisma. The latter's original Christian characterization of an individual as having been personally endowed with the grace of God was famously extended by Max Weber to spiritual leadership in general. and thus to both Christian, Jesus, Joseph Smith, Billy Graham, and other, Muhammad, the Baal Shem Tov, Maharishi Mahesh Yoga, religious leaders. In fact, it was also extended by Weber to political as well as military leadership, thereby also being attributed to individuals such as Julius Caesar, Napoleon Bonaparte, Winston Churchill, and Mahatma Gandhi, and has since been even further popularly extrapolated to the domains of art, Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, music, Franz Liszt, Elvis Presley, film, James Dean, Greta Garbo, sport, Michael Jordan, Usain Bolt, as well as science, Albert Einstein, Stephen Hawking. Charisma is ultimately characterized by its association with specific individuals' alleged extraordinariness. A charismatic leader's qualities thus include pronouncedly exceptional skills, such as the ability to inspire people, predict the future, and/or heal. What characterizes allegedly charismatic figures, in short, is their perceived image as atypical, they're being considered extraordinary and treated as endowed with specifically exceptional powers or qualities. Such individuals are thereby specifically characterized as antithetical to whatever we conventionally consider ordinary. In stark contrast to other forms of authority based, for example, on formal rules and abstract principles, charismatic authority, as famously identified by Weber, is thus associated with the allegedly unique and thereby distinctive qualities of the specific individuals to whom the charisma is singularly attributed. Such authority, in other words, is thus based on those particular individuals' alleged personal qualities as specific persons, and as such, is grounded in a pronouncedly person-centric vision of personhood. It would therefore be utterly inconceivable, for example, to envision Benito Mussolini applying for an ultimately generic position of A rather than the Duce, or, for that matter, Abraham for a position of A instead of the founder of monotheism. In his presidential nomination acceptance speech at the 2016 Republican National Convention, then-candidate Donald Trump told prospective voters, "Nobody knows the system better than me, which is why I alone can fix it." That pronouncement, so prophetically emblematic of Trump's presidential as well as post-presidential vision of utterly personalized politics, in marked contrast to the notion of voting, for example, for a Democrat or a Republican instead of for a specific person, succinctly captures the essence of charismatic authority, effectively foreshadowing his later reputation as a different kind of, not an ordinary, president. Indeed, as Air Force One lifted off the runway 4.5 years later, carrying him on his final trip as a sitting president, hours before the inauguration of his successor, Joe Biden, his pronouncedly defiant parting message beaming from the loudspeakers was, quite characteristically, Frank Sinatra's rendition of My Way, Paul Anka's famous tribute to personal distinctiveness. "For what is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he has naught to say the things he truly feels, and not the words of one who kneels. The record shows I took the blows and did it my way." Attributing charisma, continues Weber, usually implies a complete personal devotion to its alleged possessor. And during the final months of Trump's presidency, let alone his early post-presidency, America's Republican Party indeed chose to follow the path of personal loyalty over that of ultimately impersonal policy by establishing a so-called cult of personality, the modern political form of charismatic authority, so famously exemplified by Adolf Hitler in Germany, Joseph Stalin in the Soviet Union, Mao Zedong in China, Kim Il-sung in North Korea, Enver Hoxha in Albania, Juan Perón in Argentina, Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Sepah Murat Niyazov in Turkmenistan, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. It thus came as no surprise when, in summer 2021, Trump's Save America Political Action Committee in fact urged his supporters to start carrying a red and gold embossed official Trump card plastic badge as a public display of their total personal loyalty to him. Generic, what personhood? In sharp contrast to personalness, which highlights individuals' specificity, impersonality involves foregrounding their genericity. As exemplified by contrasting the ultimately impersonal act of disclosing sensitive financial information about oneself to the Internal Revenue Service agent who happens to process one's tax returns, or making a confession to an effectively generic police investigator, for instance, to that of confiding in a specific close friend, it basically involves envisioning as well as relating to people in a way that does not depend on their personal identity. Consider, for example, a situation in which a company representative asks a customer to provide identification documentation. Rather than being an instance of one specific individual personally distrusting another, it actually constitutes a routine, pronouncedly impersonal request made by an essentially generic company representative, an imperson, so to speak, from an equally generic customer, yet another imperson, regardless of the specific personal identities of the particular individual incumbents of those two social roles. As such, it would therefore also be made by any other company representative from any other customer in a similar situation. That explains the common use of the effectively impersonal expression, "It's nothing personal," or for that matter, "Don't take it personally, he does that to everyone." In other words, so goes the argument, "Don't take it personally," work out what is specifically about you and what is a general complaint that you happen to get. When it's not specific to you, don't take it as if it was. Such pronouncedly non-person-centric and therefore impersonal social logic also underlies the way the laws governing the relations between landlords and their tenants, or employers and their employees, or for that matter traffic rules, are typically articulated, so that if two cars arrive at an intersection at the same time, for example, the right-of-way goes to the car on the right, regardless of its driver's personal identity. Rather than going to a specific individual, in other words, it actually goes to anyone who happens to be on the right, no matter who he or she is. In stark contrast to specific someone-ness, such generic anyone-ness, indeed, is what impersonality basically implies. Consider also the way people nowadays screen potential romantic partners in online dating, or used to do in pre-digital newspaper purportedly personal ads, where ultimately specific individuals are nevertheless often featured and thereby envisioned generically in terms of their race, sexual orientation, occupation, or general political bent, for instance. Like recruiters screening job applicants' resumes, dating apps thus effectively transform particular individuals' supposedly personal characteristics into ultimately generic components of by and large impersonal so-called profiles. Indeed, There is an ultimately impersonal dimension to the way we have always been choosing our romantic partners. After all, even modern Western non-arranged choices that may appear strictly person-centric, and as such, personal, nevertheless involve tacit impersonal considerations based, for example, on gender, age, ethnicity, religion, and social class. This is quite evident in the case of both the generic categories people prefer, tall, college-educated, living in the Boston metropolitan area, and those they either explicitly or at least implicitly avoid, such as same-sex, interracial, or ones involving excessive genealogical proximity. We thus tacitly refrain from even considering members of certain social categories, parents, siblings, other close relatives, as potential romantic partners, effectively regarding them as erotically irrelevant. And given the conventional tacit norm of compulsory heterosexuality, despite the fact that I never consciously confined my romantic choices to female potential partners, I likewise always tacitly assumed that being a man, those were indeed my only options. Consider also in this regard the effectively generic commitment then-candidate Biden made in 2020 to appoint a black woman, that is, what, to the United States Supreme Court if he were in fact to become president 2 years before his pronouncedly person-centric official decision to nominate Ketanji Brown Jackson, that is, specifically, who for that job. Indeed, as evidenced by comparing the set of characters listed on the first page of a play script to the eventual list of the cast members printed in the play's theatrical program, or, for that matter, a preliminary discussion of a department's hiring needs when drafting an academic job advertisement, as articulated in such terms as an environmental sociologist or a criminologist, to the eventual discussion of the actual candidates, even when people are ultimately related as specific individuals, they are often initially envisioned in terms of their effectively generic social roles. By the same token, even though in the late 2020 COVID-19 vaccine rollouts, it was ultimately specific individuals who actually got vaccinated, they were nevertheless, in fact, initially viewed as members of unmistakably generic categories, such as elderly people with underlying conditions, or first responders. Relating to individuals in terms of specifically who they are is thus often preceded by envisioning them in terms of generically what they are. Furthermore, as so evocatively captured by Emile Durkheim's notion of homo duplex, every individual is actually envisioned by others as a combination of both personal and impersonal elements of personhood, and can therefore in fact be related to personally as well as impersonally. The tremendous symbolic significance of switching from Sir, that is, generically what, to Ashwin, that is, specifically who, notwithstanding, even proper names are only rarely strictly singular, indeed constituting a combination of personal as well as ultimately impersonal gender, ethnic, generational identifying elements, thereby reminding us that as effectively complementary versions of personhood, personalness and impersonality are by no means mutually exclusive. In fact, personalness and impersonality are but the ideal typical opposite poles of a spectrum, actually featuring many combinations of the two, as exemplified, for instance, by pronouncedly ritualized, and as such highly scripted, yet nonetheless person-centric social occasions, ranging from courtroom trials and award ceremonies to birthday parties, weddings, as well as funerals. Therefore, although I purposely exaggerate the conceptual contrast between them for analytical reasons, They are effectively relational terms, ultimately referring only to more persons.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?